Warming temps and heavy rains can spell trouble for your home. Don't wait for a problem. Get a free foundation inspection from PermaSeal. Stay dry, stay protected. For peace of mind, call 800-421-SEAL or visit permaseal.net.
You're listening to Steve Bertrand on Books. You know, sometimes a small story can help to paint a much bigger picture. That's the case, in a way, with The Feather Wars by James H. McCombs. Actually, his is not a small story at all. It's a remarkable accounting of America's assault on birds around the Gilded Age. McCombs writes about flocks of birds that could string along for hundreds of miles, birds, in this case, the passenger pigeons, which were hunted into extinction. Through McCombs' stories, we learn about the Gilded Age overall, and that, you might say, is a feather in his cap, though in this case, as you'll find out, that's not such a good thing. James, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You describe a North America that I can't imagine today when it comes to the bird populations around the continent. Explain to me how far we are today from where we were then.
Well, just recently, in the last couple of years, studies have come out that said we're down about one out of four birds, even from 1970. So it's hard for me to imagine some days when I'm driving around the country how many more birds there were back then, particularly with the passenger pigeon. So there are, we had billions of more birds back then. Of all types, passenger pigeons, waterfowl.
The passenger pigeon story is amazing to me, incredibly amazing to me, with the amount of birds that there were. I can't picture it. How did a passenger pigeon look different than what we see in our cities and in our neighborhoods now?
Well, it's similar to the mourning dove. It's about the same size. I think what's really different is how they traveled in the millions during their migrations. And they had a sort of a blue cast to them, so they were often called the blue pigeon. But they, in their migrations, they could pass over towns or places where you would block out the sun, and that the flocks would be 300 miles long, 50 miles wide. You know, these are the amazing things. This was, without a doubt, I mean, a spectacle of wildlife that we just won't ever see again. And this was east of the Mississippi. They were largely an eastern woodland bird.
I can't imagine that, a flock of pigeons 400 miles long. Like you said, block out the sun. I would imagine it would change the specter of a city for days, right? Or for a day? Or how long would it take it to pass over?
Well, hours and hours, 12 hours sometimes. You know, it would depend. This was happening in different places as the flocks began to diminish. It was less and less, without a doubt. The last real bastion of the passenger pigeon was northern Wisconsin and northern Michigan. But at one time, that extended all the way over to, to the East Coast. But it would take hours. They would land. Sometimes their roost, where they would do their nesting, would be 20 miles long, several miles wide. There would be hundreds of pigeon nests in every tree. Sometimes they would break the branches. The tree would actually fall over from the weight of the birds. These were colonial nesting birds. They nested in vast flocks. They needed those flocks to protect themselves against predators. But they couldn't protect themselves against people, particularly in the kind of industrialized hunting that went on in the late 19th century.
What was their value that prompted the hunting? Was it food, or was it some sort of perverse pleasure that brought their extinction on?
No, it was food. People had a taste for wildlife in the late 19th century. It was not unusual to go down to your butcher shop or to have someone peddling wildlife to consume. in the cities. And so people were very accustomed to eating passenger pigeons. And so this industrialized hunting that went on after the Civil War, particularly in the 1880s, 1890s, it was to supply this market for the cities. And so they would pack barrels and with birds, and whole train loads of birds would head off from these roosting areas, headed to cities where they would be consumed.
I want to get into the feathers for caps coming up, but first, tell me about punt guns. What were punt guns and how were they used?
Oh, punt guns. Punt guns were, again, sort of this industrialized killing of waterfowl. So a punt gun was a very large shotgun, 2 inches across at the muzzle. You could put almost a pound of shot in there. They were 10 to 12 feet long, sometimes weighed a couple hundred pounds. You didn't hold these guns. You mounted them in these skiffs on the water that were called punt boats. And a lot of this happened on the Chesapeake Bay and in other places where you had real concentrations of waterfowl. And so the hunter, and this was a market hunter, this was somebody hunting for the market, would go out with this boat with the gun mounted on it at night, go into a raft of sleeping ducks and sneak in there and then fire the gun. You would throw out all this shot, and it would kill dozens of birds at a time. And then they would gather them up, reload the gun, and go out again. I mean, they were not illegal early on after the Civil War, but later towards 1900, they were illegal. And they were used by poachers. It took until about the 1930s before the federal game wardens and state game wardens could round all these guns up.
Well, it's amazing stories about a variety of species of birds and the sort of fashion or fads or what prompted their killing. Tell me about this phase of having feathers in your cap, right? Well, that's a phrase we use now still, right? He's got another feather in his cap. And that prompted just the elimination of whole species of birds.
Well, there were the fashion for having feathers in women's hats really came around 1870s, 1880s. And it became this craze where women's hats had to have feathers in them. And the feather trade was simply to go out and kill birds. They were known as plume hunters, and they would go out and kill birds for the feathers. The market for these, where they were manufactured, where many of the hats were manufactured, was in New York City, Paris, and London. But this resulted in the killing of tens of millions of birds worldwide, and certainly in America, many of the birds that were along the shore in the Gulf Coast and other places where you know, these pretty birds that had beautiful feathers, particularly egrets, roseate, spoonbills. But this was a kind of a fashion that went on for decades, and it got more ostentatious and more silly, actually, as time went on, where it wasn't just putting your feather in the hat. It was also to have taxidermied birds in your hat as well. And these hats became very large, very wide, sort of as a stage for this tableau of birds and feathers in the hat. And it really wasn't until the early 20th century that faded out.
There was a comedian partner of Mark Twain's that I'm sorry, I don't have his name right now, but you have a quote from him in the book that said basically, look, a beautiful hat doesn't make an ugly woman any prettier, right? And that was when the tides were turning a little bit.
Yeah, he was a co-author of Twain's book about the Gilded Age, which is where the name the Gilded Age came from. A lot of people blamed women for this, that, you know, that women are killing our songsters. And without a doubt, the market demand was coming from women and from the fashion industry. But there were a lot of people involved in this industry. There were 40,000 some people involved in the millinery industry, millinery meaning the manufacturing and selling of women's hats. And the pushback slowly came in the 1890s. We have the forming of the Audubon Society. And that was largely led by women in the late 19th century that were trying to encourage other women not to wear these hats anymore. But yeah, it wasn't just the laws that came about. It was simply changing, this fashion trend that you didn't need to wear these feathers to be a fashionable woman.
I think you're talking about Florence Merriam, right? She was one of the voices coming out of the Northeastern United States.
Yeah, Florence Merriam, I really concentrated in the book with her helping to change the idea that ornithologists needed to shoot birds in order to study them. Her book was Birds Through the Opera Glass. And what she was encouraging was a bird observation using a set of opera glasses, and which, you know, optics, binoculars were still being developed then, and using a kind of a field guide, which is what her book was, to observe birds. So you don't have to shoot a bird. You can look at a bird, you can observe it. And that was a movement towards what we came to call sight ornithology, using field marks to identify birds.
Yeah, and it shouldn't be lost on part of this is that the people who cared for birds, who wanted to learn about them, they were shooting the birds too, right? I mean, not certainly in the quantity, but that's how they studied them. They would go out and shoot a rare bird so that they could learn more about it.
Well, yeah, strangely enough, we lost some birds back then, such as the Carolina parakeet, the ivory-billed woodpecker. The people who really finished off those birds at the very end were scientists and taxidermists, ornithologists who were looking to get these birds as specimens before they disappeared. So there's a strange corollary that as the bird got rare, it actually became more valuable to go out and kill the bird and get a specimen for your museum.
So we have to kill the bird to show him that we love him.
That was sort of the way it went, at least with those rare birds. But I mean, to go back a little bit, if you were interested in birds prior to Florence Merriam's book and you know, being a bird watcher, Theodore Roosevelt did this. Franklin Roosevelt did it as a boy, too. They would go out and you would collect specimens. You would shoot the bird. You would often collect their nest. That was known as nidology. Or you would collect their eggs, which was known as oology. And this is a way for a person, a young person who was interested in birds, how they would start forming a collection. And, you know, part of it was that birds are fleet. They're hard to see. Optics weren't very good. There were very few good field guides. And so the way you would identify a bird is you would see it up in a tree and you would shoot it with a shotgun, with a very fine shot that was known as dust shot, and then bring the bird down. And then you could put it into your game bag, take it home, open up this big, thick book that you couldn't really carry in the field, and then identify the bird.
You know,
it's slowly over time that changed.
It's hard. I'm trying to, in my questions, get a perspective on just how big this was. The stories in your book are amazing, and it's almost difficult to convey the losses that we inflicted on ourselves. The oologists are particularly grotesque in that they, in order to get clean eggs, right, eggs free of embryo, they would destroy eggs first. Explain that for me.
So it was the oologists did that, but the people who really did that more so were what they called the eggers. And this is the fact that people used to consume a lot of bird eggs that were not chicken eggs. Chickens were in the backyard. You know, people certainly had flocks, but there was no mass production of eggs. And so Americans ate a lot of wild bird eggs. And then this group of people made a living called eggers by going into gull, you know, colonial nesting areas like gulls and ducks, seabirds. And yes, that's exactly what they had to do. You had to get fresh eggs that didn't have embryos in them because that's what you were going to consume. So you would break all the eggs and then come back later because the birds would often lay a second clutch of eggs. And then you would gather up those fresh eggs and then you could sell them.
Lindholm Roofing has appointments available now to provide you a complete roofing, siding, gutter, and tuck pointing inspection. Call 773-283-7675 or lindholmroofing.com. Tell them that Lou sent you. Lindholm Roofing, their family has your family covered.
Tell me about Guy Bradley, who's described as a martyr here, because we should point out, or I should point out too, that, and you have, but there's this sort of fanciful whim of fashion and such. But then there were, then as you mentioned, the number of people who had an economic hand in this, and that it was industry, it was ways that people in small rural towns made a living. And along comes Guy Bradley, who sort of, I don't know, has a St. Paul moment where he changes
yes.
his view. Tell me.
Well, Guy Bradley grew up in the wilds of Florida in the 1880s, and as a young man looking to get some cash because it was an economy that didn't have a lot of cash, they would shoot birds and sell the plumes to passing boats or to lighthouse keepers. There was some sort of middleman who would buy these. So Guy was a plume hunter, and then he moved south to what is now the Everglades National Park in an area, a little town down there called Flamingo. It was sort of the edge of the earth at that time. It was very inaccessible. And Guy and his neighbors made a living hunting birds, and among other things too. Guy gets to the point that he understands that these birds are just disappearing and this is not something that he wanted to participate in anymore. And there were actually syndicates of hunters that were being hired by these millinery interests in New York City to go out and kill birds. And so Guy decides that he's going to be go to the other side, which is he becomes a game warden. Through the sheriff's department. This was a new law that was passed in Florida right around the turn of the century. But he was seen as a traitor to many of his neighbors, that he was on, you know, the wrong side. And what eventually happens is that he's trying to protect some of these rookeries, some of these areas that have yet to been exploited by plume hunters. And eventually he's murdered by one of his neighbors. While he's trying to make an arrest. And he becomes a martyr to the bird movement. And it's a really tragic story. I have a whole chapter in the book that talks about this. I mean, the best person to catch a poacher is a former poacher. And that's exactly what Guy Bradley was at that time, was he had been a plume hunter. He knew how these people operated.
And so what turned the tide? Was there a singular event or singular person that sort of ended this? I mean, we're talking about this feather war coming on several different fronts as well, whether it's culinary or fashion or whatever have you. How is it that the tide turned?
Well, it was multifaceted in the sense that the American Ornithologists Union, the Audubon folks, the Audubon Society was helping to fund some of these game wardens, known as bird wardens at that time. And you're right, there was a lot of violence. It wasn't just Guy Bradley. There were other folks who were killed. It really was multifaceted in the sense that sport hunting was emerging at that time, and sport hunters saw market hunters, plume hunters, as people who were sort of outlaws, and that they were looking and lobbying for more laws. And so that, so more laws were coming into effect. And what was really important was the federal government slowly coming into protecting birds. And that really began in 1900 with the Lacey Act, which was a way of cutting down on market hunting by making it hard to transport feathers and birds for meat across state borders. And then it was the Migratory Bird Act and then the Migratory Bird Treaty. But one of the important things was fashion changed. So the demand was slowly ebbing through the 20th century. And then you have World War I, and war changes a lot of things, and war changed fashion. And I have a little bit in there about Coco Chanel, the designer who looked at these bird hats and said, you know, how can a woman think under something like that? She called them bird nest. And, you know, as fashion changed, as hemlines went up and, you know, the whole Victorian style of women's dress changed, these bird hats kind of went out the window. And so you have women who are cutting their hair, wearing these tight fitting hats, which, we think about flapper hats, you know, that they wore at that time. And so the demand went away. And that, of course, along with the laws and everything else, and people's change about that we ought not to be killing birds, we ought to be saving birds, all of that factored in.
You write in your book and that it's impossible to know, but there are some estimates that through all of this, Florida lost maybe 95% of its wading birds. You live in the UP of Michigan. You talk about walking there. Imagine, if you will, walking through the Upper Peninsula in 1900 or 1868 versus today. What is it that you would have seen then that you don't see now? Or what is it that you see now that you didn't see then?
Well, that's right. What you see is you see forest. And you see trees, and you don't see very far off the road because the trees are so very thick. In 1900, 1920, most of the Upper Peninsula was brush, and the forest had been completely cut down, and then there was fires raging over the land at that time. And this was all part of that, you know, Gilded Age idea. That no matter how many trees you cut down, there would be more. No matter how many buffalo you shot, there would always be more because there always had been. No matter how many birds you shot, there would always be more because there always had been. So, you know, the forest at the same time, you know, were sort of like the birds. And, of course, we have Theodore Roosevelt coming in around 1900, who's setting aside large tracts of land. And also bird refuges too. So yeah, I mean the Upper Peninsula is a second growth forest. It's not like the original forest, but it has a lot of what was once there now. And some of the species are coming back that had been extirpated.
Canadian geese were nearly, or Canada geese were nearly gone, and they're back. And you know, people, I've read interviews that you've done and heard them, and people sort of laugh. Well, I'm not sure that's a good thing. Well, it is a good thing, but it just shows that there can be successes here as well. The idea that birds are sort of a precursor when it comes to damage to the environment, and you mentioned at the outset of this interview that we've maybe lost 1 in 4 birds since the 1970s. Part of your book is not about the crisis that was, but about the crisis that is or is coming, right? We talk about or we hear about wind turbines, but I don't know that they're the biggest threat that birds are facing these days.
probably not. I mean, there is a whole thing about, do wind turbines kill birds? They do. That can be mitigated and by placement, but they're hardly the big killers of birds. I mean, the way I wrote the book was that the vast majority is about the past, but the preface and the epilogue are about today. And we are in a bird crisis today that has been identified by lots of studies, that we're losing birds. We're losing some of our common birds, and particularly our grassland birds. And again, it's because of development. It's because of pesticides. It's because of we're planting fence row to fence row and leaving very little room for birds. And there are things that people can do. Some of the biggest threats to birds today, or the biggest killer of birds, are house cats that are allowed to roam freely. They kill over 1 billion birds a year. We're also learning that birds flying into glass windows, which I think most people have experienced, is a real danger. There's ways we can mitigate that. And there's also ways that we can make our backyards, around our home, much more friendly to birds.
Think of that, though, to the cat number, 1 billion, as high as 3.7 billion birds killed a year by cats. That's a phenomenal thing. And I like the way you put it in perspective, in that, you know, if we're talking about clean energy versus cats roaming the neighborhood, I think it's probably a pretty easy choice. And I know there are efforts too, like here in Chicago, particularly at McCormick Place, right along Lake Michigan, where, birds were dying one night by 1,000. And they're trying to mitigate that. And I think they've had some success there, right? Is that correct?
That's right. I mean, they have. A lot of cities are turning off lights in many of these buildings during migration times. And it is making a difference. So awareness is important. I think that's growing in relation to glass and cats as well.
You talked about birdscaping your yard. You know, a lot of us plant milkweed to help with the monarchs because we're thinking we're helping the environment. What can we do to help the birds?
Well, in the Midwest especially, you have prairie plants that can be planted. I have a whole area of my yard in Michigan that is in perennial prairie plants or wildflowers. And of course, that creates a cover for the birds. It also gives them seed that they can eat, those seed heads over the winter. So I think part of it's not putting pesticides and fertilizers on your lawn, having a more organic lawn, cutting down the amount of turf grass that you have in your property. I mean, a lot of us want lawns, but do we need, an entire landscape full of lawns? And a lot of these plantings are not difficult to maintain, especially the perennials that come back on their own. And, giving birds, food sources and cover in our yard are really important.
Well, it's an amazing story. It's a story about American. It's a sort of a micro story about a macro American story when it comes to conservation and the Gilded Age. And I don't think I've done it justice, James, in our interview, because it's just the detail in there and the jaw dropping practices that we had and the losses that we've suffered are just phenomenal. The name of the book is The Feather Wars. James H. McCommons is the author. And James, it was great to talk to you. Thank you for writing this, and I wish you continued success.
I thank you. I appreciate being on.
That's author James McCommons writing about his book, The Feather Wars. It's a fascinating read. You should check it out. James is also the author of Waiting on a Train. The subtitle there is The Embattled Future of Passenger Rail. It was named by the Library Journal as the best nonfiction book of 2009. All right, that's going to wrap things up for Steve Bertrand on Books this week. I'd love to hear from you. You can send me an email at stevebertrandonbooks@gmail.com.
or follow me for where you pick up your typical podcasts. Subscribe maybe on Spotify or WGNradio.com. You can subscribe to this one too, and I hope you will. Till next time, keep turning those pages.